Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Triangulation is brought to you by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Triangulation, episode 275, recorded Monday, November 21st, 2016, for airing November 28th, 2016. Weapons of Math Destruction. Triangulation is brought to you by Basecamp. If you're running your business on emails, texts, chat, or meetings, you're doing it the hard way. Luckily, there's a better way. Try Basecamp free at basecamp.com/twit. And by CuriosityStream, a subscription streaming service that offers over 1,500 documentaries and nonfiction series from the world's best filmmakers. Get unlimited access starting at just $2.99 a month. And for you, our audience, the first 2 months are completely free if you sign up at curiositystream.com/twit and use the offer code TWIT. And by Epson's new EcoTank printers with Epson's line of SuperTank all-in-one printers. You can print thousands of documents without running out of ink. EcoTank is loaded and ready to print when you are. Visit Epson.com/EcoTank to find out more. It's time for Triangulation, a show where we get together with some of the most interesting people in technology and talk about things of I think, deeper in many cases than other shows on the network because we have a whole hour with them. And, of course, with you, too. And that's why we call it Triangulation. If you join us live at 11 a.m. on Mondays, Pacific time, 2 p.m. Eastern, 1900 UTC, you can be in the chat room at irc.twit.tv. And your feedback in the chat room is really the third leg of the triangulation, the third side of the triangle, third leg of the stool. And very much appreciated. Today is a great day to talk to Kathy O'Neill. She is a mathematician, Harvard trained. In fact, runs the blog mathbabe.org. Hi, Kathy.
Hi.
Great to see you.
Thanks for having me.
Taught math at Barnard College in New York. Worked for a hedge fund. You were one of those quants.
That's right. I worked at D.E. Shaw.
A quant at D.E. Shaw. And has worked as a data science. Started the lead program in data journalism at Columbia, which I think is fascinating. She's written a book called Doing Data Science. And her latest, also appears in the Slate Money podcast, her latest is Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. Kathy, welcome.
Thank you.
So nice to have you on Triangulation. Every time we talk about privacy on our shows, somebody always mentions, usually John C. Dvorak, the reason you want to stay private is because insurance companies are going to see you're eating that donut and they're going to deny you insurance. And I always respond, they know that stuff already. Then I read your book and I realized, oh, they really do know. They know a lot more about you than you might think. Let's start with big data. What is we hear this a lot now, and I think we're clearly in the big data era. What is big data?
Well, what is big data? It really depends on who you are. If you are a technical person, then probably big data has a kind of technical meaning, and the question is how big is big. And the answer is usually like bigger than you can fit on your home computer. And since your home computer gets bigger every couple of years, that, of course, is a shifting definition.
Yeah, I got terabytes on my home computer now. So you must be talking petabytes.
Yeah, exactly. But I think for the sake of my book and for this conversation, I think big data is a little bit different. Big data is fundamentally, it's kind of a new way of using data to predict humans, and it relies crucially on the assumption that things that happened in the past, human behavior that happened in the past, is going to repeat. So it's fundamentally predictable, and it also typically relies on the idea of not having direct measurement of stuff you're interested in. So you infer from indirect measurements. So we might not know whether you're happy or you're sad, but we know that you've tweeted things that seem optimistic. So we can conclude that you're happy. Unlike old school data and old school statistics, where you would be sort of directly measured. You'd be part of some kind of statistical experiment, and they would actually ask you questions and you'd answer. And not to say that you're always answered precisely and correctly, but at least they were asking the specific question they wanted. In the era of big data, we are trying to constantly infer things like your interest, your engagement, your likelihood of buying something, your likelihood of voting for somebody, not based on a direct question, but on indirect inference.
So two things have happened. One is that thanks to technology, computers, the internet, more and more of our data is being captured. You mentioned even sentiment analysis on our tweets. I mean, huge, vast amounts of data are being captured about us. But really, the data is meaningless unless you have models and the math, and that's where your math background is so interesting, to do something with it, to analyze it, to extract information. Are we getting – clearly, we've got more information. Are we getting better at parsing that information?
Yeah, we really are. Not only are we collecting massive troves of information on every person, every consumer, every voter in the country, but our techniques are constantly improving. So I talk about this a lot because when people think about, oh, I don't want people to collect data on me, I say, well, we've already collected data on you. And not only that, but like the kind of inference we can make from the data we've collected about you already might be limited, but in 10 years, people might be able to go back to this data, this old data, and infer stuff about you that you really don't want to know, don't want people to know.
So I remember 20 years ago doing an interview with a company that really from your zip code could pretty well predict what kind of car you drove, what kind of magazines you subscribed to, what stores you shopped at, and what you bought at those stores. I mean, we think of big data as really being part of the information era, but there's a history of this that goes back a lot farther.
Oh, absolutely. And I should say, like, probably the most advanced kind of big data analysis is being used in politics nowadays. But it didn't start, like, with Obama's analytic team, although Obama's analytic team definitely pushed it into the big data era. They had, like, marketing campaigns going back decades. And similarly, as you say, car insurance companies have been slicing and dicing all the data they can find about people for decades as well. And they've been trying to infer the likelihood of you getting into a car accident based on things like where you live and what kind of car you have. I think one of the big differences now is because there is so much data about us and so much of it is actually traceable to our identity. It's now possible for these companies to buy large data sets and combine the ones that they used to use with these new kinds of things. Or another way of saying it is that they can now endow their old-fashioned data sets with a lot more context, and the context is stuff coming from social media or other kinds of sort of fingerprints that you leave on the internet.
So is it safe to assume that at this point the companies that are interested in this kind of stuff have a very accurate profile of almost everybody in the United States, that they can pick and choose from? You mentioned, you know, people who graduated from college and got a job within 9 months after they got college. They can do that kind of granular analysis now. I mean, that horse has left the barn.
You know, yes and no. I mean, there's a lot of analysis that is still quite flawed, and people use it anyway. And I should mention that, like, from the perspective of a marketer, and many of these things are marketing issues or maybe political messaging, which is a kind of marketing. From the perspective of those kinds of people, they don't need it to be 100% accurate for it to be very useful, right? For them, it's like better than random.
Right.
And that's the bar that they're setting. So they don't need to be completely accurate. The issue I have with many of these, so there's two basic issues. One that I talk about in my book. One is that when you're making decisions that are very, very important for people, like whether they can get a job or whether how long do they have to go to prison or something like that, it's not enough to be better than random. You should actually have 100% accuracy, or at least a reasonable approximation of very accurate. That's the first thing. And the second thing, which is just as important, and it goes to the question you asked, is, and sometimes we can predict people rather accurately, but we can't really explain why they're going to do what we predict that they're going to do. Like, in other words, we can predict they're going to do something. But the question that we never ask, and big data does not help answer, is why are they going to do that?
Very interesting. Very interesting. So maybe we have some overconfidence then in our models and in what they can do. And of course, the point of your book is that the insights we gain from big data are often misused. Are they misused because we imperfectly understand it, or we impute more accuracy to it, or is it misused because we're using it in ways that are dangerous?
It depends on the model, in the example that you have. I think the answer is all of the above, depending on which specific example that we have. But I think the overriding issue that I picked up on and that I wanted to refute and bring attention to, and the reason I wrote the book, is that people have this combination of fear and admiration for mathematics and for mathematical modeling. And therefore, when someone says, oh, this is the result of an algorithm, they stop asking questions. They assume that any kind of score, mathematical scoring system, is inherently fair and objective and true and good. And it's, of course, not true. Not true. That's just an inaccurate assessment. But because so many people are afraid of math, they don't ask the question. They don't hold the algorithms accountable. And we end up using really flawed algorithms, and they're flawed in different ways. And we can go through a few examples to see how they're flawed. But at the end of the day, they really do destroy lives, and sometimes they even hurt the society. So it's important to understand this.
You write, more and more I was worried about the separation between technical models and real people, and about the moral repercussions of that separation. In fact, I saw the same pattern emerging that I'd witnessed in finance. And this is the key here. A false sense of security was leading to widespread use of imperfect models, self-serving definitions of success, and growing feedback loops. Those who objected were regarded as nostalgic Luddites. Oh, you're just living in the past. We got science. We got math. Yeah,
that's exactly right.
That's a risky thing.
Part of what's going on there is that data scientists like myself, we are not trained to think about the human beings behind the algorithms that we're developing. We're not trained to think about what the repercussions on a family or an individual might be if they are badly scored, misscored, unfairly scored with these algorithms that we create, which are mostly scoring algorithms. So we are just following our noses, which is to say we're doing what our bosses are telling us, and we're optimizing on profit without regard for the consequences in human terms.
When did you personally come to this realization? I mean, at some point, something must have happened that you said, whoa, wait a minute. Or were you all along aware of this disconnect?
Oh, no, I was incredibly naive.
Yeah.
I should say that, like, what happened was I was incredibly naive, and I went into finance being so incredibly naive. But I witnessed the financial crisis in a firsthand sense because I was working at the hedge fund D.E. Shaw, which was 20% owned by Lehman Brothers. It was a big deal, and I got to really see from the inside what was going on, and I was super disillusioned by what I saw. What I essentially saw were a bunch of people, greedy people, making money off of, again, fear and admiration of mathematics in the when you think about the weapon of the mortgage-backed securities and those AAA ratings. So those AAA ratings, which people believed in. They thought that meant the mortgage-backed securities were safe investments. Those AAA ratings were false. They were just lies that were set out by the credit rating agencies to sell more mortgage-backed securities. And they were mathematical lies. They were supposed to indicate that a bunch of PhD mathematicians were like diligently working on the data and making sure that everything was safe. But in fact, it just wasn't. It was a lie. So I saw firsthand what I thought of to myself as a weaponized form of mathematics. Like, this is taking advantage of people's trust in mathematics. And the truth is, mathematics does deserve people's trust. But this stuff isn't math. This is corrupt practices behind, like, living behind a shield of mathematics. It's not actual math. And so I was disgusted by that and left finance. But what had happened was my eyes had been opened. So I was much more aware of this possibility. And so once I worked as a data scientist in industry and in the world of the startups, and advertising, online advertising and so on, I was much more aware of this possibility, and I kept on seeing it everywhere I looked. And that's why I quit my job to write the book.
Wow. We're talking to Kathy O'Neill. She's a mathematician who wants to defend the purity of math and point out that the way it's being used is not right. Her new book, Weapons of Math Destruction, which is, by the way, one of the best names of the year. How Thank Big you. Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. The book is just out now from Crown and is on, as you see, on hardcover, but also on Kindle and a New York Times bestseller. We'll have more with Kathy in just a bit on triangulation. We'll be back with Kathy O'Neill in just a second on Weapons of Math Destruction. But I have to remind you, our show today brought to you by another guest who's been on the show before. Actually, a couple of guys I've interviewed multiple times. Jason Fried, David Heinemeier Hansen. David was just on talking about Ruby on Rails. He created Ruby on Rails so that he could write Basecamp. Remember, it was at 37 Signals with Jason, and now they're, of course, called Basecamp because Basecamp became wildly popular. It is a tool for teams that want to stay on track, and the new Basecamp just came out. I just got a tour of it. It is fantastic. Basecamp 3. It gives your team one central location to keep track in the cloud, by the way. So, you know, you can look at it anywhere on your phone, at work, at home, on the road. You can keep track of where things are, where they stand. If you're trying to manage a company and doing it with a hodgepodge, you know, collection of email and text messaging and chats and meetings, this is the solution you've been looking for. Change your chaotic work style into something that it puts you in control and actually gives you the chance to relax and just get the job done. That's the philosophy behind Basecamp. You can post announcements, share files, get feedback, track what gets done, by whom, when. When it's done, you'll know. It's a great solution for in-house teams, but also for remote workers, even client collaboration. And the fact that it's one flat rate, no matter how big your team, is also good for peace of mind. You don't have to say, oh, should I add this guy to the team? It's going to cost me more. No, it doesn't. It's one flat rate. And you can include external teams or even clients who don't you work with but don't work for you and give them access just to a slice of it, which is really nice. No per-user fees. Add as many projects and people as you need. You can also set – this is more of that you know – calmness. When you start a business or you start a job, often with a small team, it's easy because you could talk to everybody, a few people, but then it gets bigger. And by the time you get to 15 people, we experience this. You don't know who's working on what. Communication becomes difficult. You need a solution, and this is the right solution. We are using it right now. By the way, we're not the only ones. 100,000 companies use Basecamp right now to keep track of our live events production team. Colleen uses it. She says it's great. It's intuitive. Gives her the visual overview, the dashboard, lets you know where everything is. You can assign tasks. You can track productivity. There's great reports and daily updates. They use the email reminders. Kara likes those, which help everyone stay on track. You can even, and I love this, set your work schedule, right? So you can say, I only want notifications during my work day. Don't bother me at home. That's part of this whole thing of work when you're at work, get the job done efficiently so that you can have a life. Nothing else out there like Basecamp. It is well thought out. Try it and you will not look back. And by the way, you can try it for free when you go to basecamp.com/twit. Basecamp.com/twit. We thank Basecamp. They make that triangulation possible. Let's get on with it. Our interview recorded a couple of days ago with Kathy O'Neill and Weapons of Math Destruction. You're watching Triangulation. Our guest, this is really right up our alley because everybody watching our shows, for the most part, are technical people. They're mathematically focused. They're into technology. We are all fascinated by technology. And I think like you talked before the break about your realization that it was being misused, the math was being misused. Like you, I think we all are kind of sensing that, I remember in the mid-90s being so excited by the potential of the internet and how it was going to bring the world together and democratize. And here we are 20 years later, kind of with a sense, it's a little more dystopian than we had expected, and that is being misused in ways that we don't like. And I think as technologists and technology enthusiasts, it's important for us to note this and to fight to preserve its integrity instead of let it be used in this kind of, well, ultimately destructive way. So give me some examples, and your book is loaded with them, of how the big data models are being misused today.
So I'll give you two examples. And you said it very well. It is the opposite of what we were hoping for the internet. The first example, though, is not an internet example. It's an assessment model for teachers, public school teachers. And it stems from a sort of long campaign by many presidents to sort of be that president who fixed education, whatever that means. Well, what it means is we have a problem with what's called the achievement gap, which is that to say, like, rich kids are doing better on standardized test scores than poor kids. And the idea is, well, we're going to close that achievement gap, which is a worthy goal. But the way we've gone about it is we've been trying to find bad teachers to get rid of bad teachers. And finding bad teachers is much harder than it sounds. And the argument is basically that principals will protect bad teachers. So we need to use some kind of objective mathematical scoring system to find those bad teachers. And actually, there's been like more than one generation of such assessments. And the first one was really dumb. It didn't work. But let me tell you what it was, because it sets up the one that actually I want to talk about. The first one was basically you labeled a teacher as a failing teacher if a large percentage of their students was not passing their standardized test at some kind of proficiency level, which is to say they weren't getting past a certain score on their standardized tests. And the problem was, as I already mentioned, poor kids don't do as well as rich kids on tests. That this was essentially putting the label of failure on teachers of poor kids. And it wasn't fair because, you know, if you have a bunch of kids that failed their third grade standardized test very badly and you get half of them up to passing level on fourth grade, but still half of them are failing, then you've done a lot more good as a teacher than somebody who was in fifth grade who started out with kids that all passed in third grade, and then in fourth grade, only 75% of them passed. So the idea was we have to somehow account for where they were a year ago in order to measure a teacher, whether they're passing or failing. So the second generation of these of teacher assessments, which is called the value-added model, sometimes called the growth model, and there's different variations of it, but they essentially come down to this idea where you have an expected score for each student in your class. If you're a teacher of a class, every student in your class has an expected end of year score, and then they have the actual end of year score, what they get at the end of the year with you. So if their expected end of year score was 75, but they actually got an 80, you will be given credit for those 5 points. If they had an expected end of year score of 75, but they actually got a 70, then you're on the hook for those 5 points. So the idea is you are going to be on the hook for the difference between the expected and the actual scores. Now, it sounds pretty reasonable, and it actually might be reasonable if, statistically speaking, it were a robust thing. Unfortunately, there's just so many sources of uncertainty for both that expected score and the actual score. Just to give you some idea, kids do better if they've eaten breakfast that day. Kids do better if it's not too hot in the classroom, and in some classrooms have air conditioning and some classes don't. Kids do better, you know, if they're having a stable home life. There are all sorts of reasons that the actual score could vary for a given child. So there's uncertainty in their actual score. There's also, of course, uncertainty in expected score. How do you guess what a score is going to be in a year for a given kid? So anyway, the point is that those two numbers are both uncertain, and when you take the difference, you have even more uncertainty. And that kind of uncertainty, statistically speaking, it can be accounted for if you have a large enough sample size. But think about it. Classrooms are 25 kids. So you don't have a large enough sample size for the kinds of uncertainty that we're talking about. So end of day, what I'm if what it boils down to is that these scoring systems are very vary wildly. So I talked to Tim Clifford, who's a middle school teacher for 26 years in New York City. He got a 6 out of 100 for his value added model score. The next year he got a 96 out of 100.
Okay, right there, that's a sign.
Yeah, and
wrong.
He didn't change the way he was teaching.
Right.
He has a theory about like the kinds of students in the first year's class, the kinds of students in the second year's class. But at the end of the day, these numbers are supposed to sort of tell you whether you're a good teacher or not. And they told him he was a shamefully bad teacher. And then they told him he was an exceptionally good teacher.
Right.
And he, in the meantime, was the same person. So it's just not a good scoring system. And in spite of that, these scores are being used for high stakes decisions. And so I interviewed Sarah Wasaki, who in Washington, D.C. area school was actually fired for her bad assessment with 205 other teachers in the same year. So you have these statistically unsound algorithms, and they're just wreaking havoc on these school systems. And the goal was to get rid of bad teachers. The actual result of it has probably been to get rid of good teachers. Good teachers, if they see this kind of, you know, paradigm that they're working in and living in, they get another job,
yeah.
And they flee.
Yeah.
And that's what you've seen. You've seen early retirement. You've seen people fleeing to the suburbs. The rich suburbs do not have this kind of regimen. So you're really losing good teachers instead of losing bad teachers. So it's failed on every level. And so it's what I call a weapon of math destruction. It qualifies. It's important. It's secret. I didn't mention that nobody ever gets their scores explained to them, and they can't appeal them. There's no accountability. So it's influential, it's secret, and it's destructive.
But we're trying, and maybe we see this mistake again and improve it again. Or is the problem in numeracy on the part of the lawmakers, the people who are making these rules? Is it that they don't understand math, or that we're just, you know, we're used to this notion, certainly in Silicon Valley, of gradual refinement. Maybe we just need to refine the model.
That's a really good question. I think one of the reasons that's not going to happen anytime soon with the teacher value added model example is that there's no feedback loop. There's no ground truth. This is not. There's no comparison number. Teachers are not being simultaneously evaluated with a trusted qualitative assessment score. So there's no comparison like, oh, you know, you got a value added model score of 22, but your qualitative assessment score was 82. We have to update our model. There's no feedback loop like that. Think about Amazon, like think about Netflix. Every good big data algorithm has a feedback loop, has some kind of ground truth. Oh, we recommended this movie to you, but you hated it. That means we have to improve our algorithm. There's no such feedback loop going on with the teacher value added models.
There might be a feedback loop, but it's on such a large time scale. Like 10 years from now, we'll see a failed education system. We can go, oops, that didn't work. But
that's a really good point.
Yeah. Too late.
It's on a decade long. It's a decade long feedback loop, but it's not fast enough.
What about the innumeracy issue, though? This issue, I remember in high school, you're too young to remember something called a slide rule, but we used slide rules, and one of the values of it was you learned about scientific precision, because with a slide rule, you could give a result that was 0.00001, but you learned that that was not within the realm of precision. And so but with calculators and computers, there's this impression that it's almost infinite precision. You don't learn that there's some sense of there's a little slop factor in here.
And that's a great point. And that goes straight to the secrecy element, which I just mentioned. Nobody got their scores explained to them. But I'm a data person, right? So I could understand
it. You understood it. Yeah.
Well, I could understand it if I could get the formula. But I filed a Freedom of Information Act request to get the source code for the version that was being used in New York City public schools, and I was denied. And when I reached out to the people that actually built the model, they explained to me that by the contract that they had with the city of New York, no one in the city of New York had access to this formula.
Geez.
No one. So it wasn't just I couldn't see the formula. Nobody could see the
formula. Is it because it's proprietary?
Yes.
Well, how can you make public policy on proprietary formulas? That's terrible.
It's actually probably illegal, so yeah. Some lawyers have told me. But it goes to the very important point that's a commonality with all the algorithms I talk about in my book that I describe as weapons of mass destruction, which is that they are all unaccountable. So if you're talking about numeracy, like understanding basic statistics and how does that play a part, the answer is it doesn't play a part at all. We are expected to accept these scoring systems on blind faith because we're expected to believe that someone very smart is making sure this is good. But we're not allowed to look into it. We're not allowed to question it. We're not allowed to push back. And we're not allowed to understand how these scores are computed. So there's no accountability. So there's really no numeracy required or involved.
Amazing. It's directly analog to your experience at D.E. Shaw and the AAA rated bonds. If you don't understand where the number comes from and you can't ever find out where the number comes from, all you could do is either trust it or not trust it. And people are just going to default to trust. You said you have two examples. So there's the teaching example, clearly a failed model. What's the other one?
Yeah. Well, let's see, which one should I choose? I mean, I'll choose.
You can do as many as you want. I love these. And I think you do this in the book, which I really like, which is instead of just asserting this, you give example after example where you can really see where the problem lies. So go ahead, take as many, do as many as you want.
I just wanted to give a quick story, which was the story of why I wrote the book. Like what really was the moment I wrote the book? Now, you have to imagine that I have left finance in disgust. I started my blog, mathbabe.org, and I've even joined Occupy at this moment. And I'm working at a startup doing...
Wow, you really got radicalized.
I did. And I started working as a data scientist in a startup, which is to say I was predicting clicks and predicting purchases on Expedia.com, like a travel website that everybody knows about. And a venture capitalist came to our company because he was considering investing in our company. And so we were all asked to, you know, come listen to him speak. And what he said, he was waxing eloquent about the future of tailored advertisement. And what he said was, I'm looking forward to the day when all I see are trips to Aruba and jet skis. And I never again have to see another University of Phoenix ad because those aren't for people like me. And everyone laughed. And that's when I said to myself, oh my God, what about the democratization for us of the internet? You know, like this, it turns out that a venture capitalist is intentionally building and creating this, the internet to silo and segregate people by class, by race, in order for them to be more easily targeted, not just by opportunities to go to Aruba or to buy a jet ski, but also to be targeted as prey by predatory industries, like for-profit colleges and for that matter, payday loans. And you know, I didn't really know much about the for-profit college industry. I looked it up. It turned out, and by the way, I had never seen a University of Phoenix ad myself, but when I looked it up, it was the number one ad buyer on Google that quarter. And I was like, wow, this is a huge deal. It's happening behind the scenes from the perspective of someone like me, a data scientist, highly educated, New York City, like white woman. I am not actually seeing the destructive force of this siloing, this marketing siloing, and the predatory nature of it, because I'm building this system where I was constructing a system that where I would never see the bad news. And I was thinking about that, you know, kind of with regards like it, I was thinking about how that looks relative to the financial crisis. And one of the things that I found as a positive about the financial crisis, and I know nobody thinks there's any positive thing to come out of the financial crisis, but there was one thing that was positive about the financial crisis, which was that everybody noticed. It destroyed the fabric of the economy and of a bunch of people's lives, but at least everyone saw the destruction. Whereas what I was seeing here was a kind of quiet degradation of people's lives that I would never see because I never see University of Phoenix ads. I never interact with people who go to the University of Phoenix and who get those worthless high school diplomas, college diplomas that are not worth any more than a high school diploma. And in the meantime, are saddled with a lot of debt. So in other words, like we have set this up so that we don't have to look at that part of the system we're creating.
You know, actually, that I know your book was written before the election, But there's a story that's emerged since the election about dark advertising on Facebook.
Yeah.
It's done exactly the same way. I think probably a huge impact on the election results was the choice by the Trump team to hire a company called Cambridge Analytica, very smart data analytics team that was able to use data from Facebook to highly target advertising. They call it dark advertising because we don't, most of us don't see it. It's targeted specifically at the person for whom the ad is intended. So if, for instance, you have in sentiment analysis kind of a dark view of the world, they'll show you scarier ads than if you have an optimistic view of the world, in which case they'll show you hopeful ads. The ads are that targeted and dark because, just as your example with, say, payday loans or the University of Phoenix, the rest of us don't see them, only the people for whom they're intended. But we've done this for years. I mean, I think of it's kind of the opposite of redlining, where loan companies build home loan companies just wouldn't do home loans to African American neighborhoods. They just redline it out, and economically it makes sense, doesn't it? I mean, this is kind of what capitalism is all about. You're maximizing your return for your advertising dollar. What's wrong with that?
Yeah. Right. And you know what? I agree with you, first of all, that the stuff with Cambridge Analytica is really scary. I have an entire chapter devoted in my book to political micro-targeting and how the fact that campaigns know so much more about us, there's so much asymmetry of information, that they can actually choose they can choose to manipulate us in exactly the way they want.
Yeah. We talk about fake news. That's just the stuff you saw way below the surface. This is being fed to people by advertising, and I think it's very, very effective. But again, what's wrong with that?
Well, listen, I'll tell you what. There's nothing that's going on now that didn't used to go on
right
before big data.
Right, we're just better at it.
We're just better at it. It's much more scalable.
Yeah.
Right. It used to be, of course, true that politicians would go to different towns and different cities and curate their message. So this is not a new thing. We saw Mitt Romney do it with his 47% comment. Like, politicians, that's what they do.
They know this.
Yeah, they change their story a little bit per, right, you know, hopefully not too much, but they do change their story depending on who they're talking to.
The difference is, you know, it was a big scandal because somebody had a camera phone and taped Mitt Romney saying this to what he thought was a private audience, and it got out. And so the difference is politicians now can't say stuff because they're in public all the time. So they hire companies like Cambridge Analytica to do this stuff under the radar.
Yeah, and exactly as you say, it was the bartender who leaked it. It wasn't the people there,
right?
So the people there probably weren't surprised or offended by what
they heard.
No, they
agreed.
Yeah, they agreed. So there's a confirmation bias going into it. And now that we can do this all directly through direct channels, email, Facebook, what have you, there is no bartender. And for that matter, there's no gumshoe journalist following the campaign from town to town, taking notes on the differences and the discrepancies of the messages. For that matter, if you think about what the journalist's job is to research the campaign promises, how can they do that in the age of Facebook? They don't get those messages. They only get their own message, their own feed. And Facebook isn't helping journalists understand how campaigns change their message to different people. So it's really become a completely opaque and unaccountable system. And going back to your question of, is there anything wrong with this? I mean, look, I think that's bad for democracy, right? I think, like, having an asymmetry of information where people get told exactly what to think by the campaigns is bad for democracy because we don't have an informed citizenry anymore. I don't know really what the politicians are promising to other people. And that's not great for democracy. In other realms and other examples in my book, I talk about the kinds of profits that companies can make using big data algorithms. And some of those things are, I think, actually illegal, and I point out there are laws against many of them, but they aren't being pursued or enforced because regulators don't understand algorithms, and sometimes regulators are also afraid and intimidated by algorithms. So that's a problem. But sometimes there are no laws. And then the question becomes, you know, do we need new laws? So I guess what I'm saying is, like, I don't expect the free market to solve this problem, because I do think there's a lot of money to be made with big data algorithms. And the question isn't, can we make money? The question is, do we want this to go on unfettered?
You talk in the book about something called predatory advertising. And you give the example of a college that fortunately the Attorney General of California put out of business. Of course, there have been many successors since then. Corinthian College, which was placing ads specifically targeting isolated, impatient individuals with low self-esteem who have few people in their lives who care about them and who are stuck and unable to see and plan well for the future. And are you saying that they can say, this is our criterion for our advertising, Facebook, would you place some ads with those people?
Pretty much, yeah. So there was a big controversy like maybe last week about how people somehow didn't know that you can tell Facebook to only show certain race your advertisement. Right. But you could also do that with salary. You could do that with all sorts of different demographic conditions. Now, they're not going to say low self-esteem. That's probably not a Facebook category. But you can get pretty precise with your demography you're targeting. And by the way, if Facebook doesn't want to do it, there's companies like Axiom, which build all sorts of lists, including emails, of people's names in various categories. And they do have relatively clear-cut predatory categories of people. And then they give you email lists for those people. And then you can, if you go to Facebook, you can say, please send this advertisement to the people with these emails. So there's a very, very well polished path for you to target people that are extremely vulnerable.
You don't have to actually have a checkbox on Facebook, because you're cross-correlating all of these databases. So the aggregation of all these databases then gives you an immense ability. And so I've answered my own question. When you read that, you realize these are predatory advertisements. They are preying on people's weaknesses, on people's financial difficulties, you talk about another college, that's essentially a for-profit college that targets welfare moms with kids, pregnant ladies, recent divorce, low self-esteem, low-income jobs, experienced a recent death, physically or mentally abused, recent incarceration, drug rehabilitation, dead-end jobs, no future. And by the way, that's not from their Facebook advertising. That's their recruiting manual.
That's their recruiting manual. And they, by the way, I don't know if it's the same college, but one of those colleges was the recruiting manual instructed recruiters to find their pain point and to like, in other words, like counsel them on what causes them the most pain. And then to promise them that if they just enrolled in this college and accepted this enormous loan from the federal aid system, then all of their problems would go away.
And to reiterate, this is a practice that's been going on forever. If you ever saw the movie Glengarry Glen Ross, they're selling swampland, Florida swampland to people, and they do exactly the same thing. It's exactly the same sales techniques. The difference is now that instead of some guy going door to door saying, you want to buy some Florida land, this is your future, this is your dream, it's going to change your life, we're doing it in an automated fashion using big data and systems that make it possible to target hundreds of millions of people one by one at each point on their particular soft spot. And that is immoral.
It's immoral. It's the scale of it that is mind-boggling. And it's not obvious how to put a stop to it, but I think the first step is to stop assuming that technology is all good and that big data algorithms are completely fair, objective, and unreasonable. So it's just like I'm just trying to get that reasonable amount of skepticism into people's brain, that this stuff might not be so great. And I don't have like a full suite of solutions for how to deal with this. But at the very least, we have to stop. We have to stop talking so much about the techno utopia world. We have to realize that these are just simply tools that could be used for good or for evil. And we have to consider our responsibilities as technologists in how to make sure that we're not hurting society with them.
We're talking to the Math Babe, self-designated, don't blame me, mathbabe.org, Kathy O'Neill, that's her blog. But she's also written a book shortlisted, or actually longlisted for the National Book Award, rightly so, a bestseller. And I'm glad to see that people are reading it, because this is, I think, vital information for everybody, because not only is this changing our society, we are also the targets of this stuff. Weapons of Math Destruction, brand new, Crown Books. We'll have more with Kathy O'Neill in just a moment. More with our guests in just a bit on Triangulation, but first a word from our sponsor. We know you're watching Triangulation, you're interested in the world, you've got an active mind, you love to learn. I've got something you're going to love. It's called Curiosity Stream. It is the world's first ad-free non-fiction streaming network. It was created by John Hendricks, who created the Discovery Channel. And it is a very affordable way to get thousands of titles, 1,500 titles, 600 hours of content, and one of the largest libraries of 4K content. If you've got a 4K TV and you're looking at stuff to watch, I love this. Over 50 hours of 4K content. And the nice thing is, and sometimes we do ads for these services and you have to say U.S. and Canada only. No, this is available worldwide, 196 plus countries. And you can watch it on the web, your browser. You can watch it on your Roku. They have a Roku app. Curiosity Stream. Just search for the Roku, the app in the Roku store, or your Android or iOS device. And then you can Chrome. The apps have Chromecast, so you can Chromecast it. There's an Amazon Fire app. There's a Kindle app. And yes, there's an Apple TV app. They just came out with that, so you can watch Curiosity Stream on your Apple TV. With a big variety, too, of science and technology content. I know you're interested in that stuff, but maybe you also like nature. I love nature. And on a 4K display, oh, man, that's how I like to watch. History. There's documentaries. There's interviews. There's lectures. Stephen Hawking's Favorite Places, which is a new documentary exclusive to Curiosity Stream. Stephen Hawking pilots a fantastical spaceship across the universe and stops at his favorite places like Saturn. Let me show you Saturn. Digits, which is a groundbreaking three-part series from Derek Muller. You know him from Veritasium on YouTube. Exploring online safety and security. It's really well done, and has interviews with Edward Snowden and Vint Cerf, the father of the Internet. Deep Time History, an exclusive three-part original documentary that tells the story of the universe's 14-billion-year history. I can go on. It's really great. Monthly plans available, annual plans. They start at $2.99 a month. So, I mean, really, this is very affordable. And we've got an even better deal for you. You can try it free if you go to curiositystream.com/twit. Normally, that's a 30-day trial. But if you use the TWIT code during the sign-up, you're going to get full unlimited access to the world's top documentaries, to nonfiction series, absolutely free for 60 days, for 2 months. This will get you into next year. This is really a great deal. Two entire months free of the world's largest nonfiction 4K library, or at least one of them anyway. Go to curiositystream.com/twit. Use the offer code TWIT at sign up. I know you want to learn because you're watching Triangulation, and I hope you're enjoying this great interview. We recorded this last week with Kathy O'Neill, and we continue on right now. Kathy O'Neill is our guest. Her book, this is a great book, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. We've been talking about online advertising preying on people, but big data and algorithms and computers can be used to hurt people in other ways. I remember you talk about the Starbucks scheduling snafu, and I remember reading this article in the New York Times some years ago about how Starbucks saved money by using automated scheduling techniques that were great for the company and for the bottom line, but were horrific for the workers because they'd have little shifts here, big shifts there, and you never knew when they were going to be working. Just a really inhumane system, but it maximized profits. The thing that made me sad is after that article in the Times came out, Starbucks said, no, we want to treat our employees well, but you report that several years later, not much had changed.
That's right. And Starbucks, is more sensitive to its reputation risk than a lot of other large companies.
Yeah, Burger King doesn't care.
No. Right? Walmart also does that practice. And Walmart is huge and has domination of the workforce.
Given the value that it offers a company, they'd be, on the one hand, you'd say, well, they'd be foolish not to. They have a responsibility to their shareholders to maximize profit.
Oh, I mean, I totally agree, and I can understand how it came about. But keep in mind how evil this stuff is. Like, you actually have the option in these algorithms, and I actually read some academic papers written by people who build these algorithms, to add a constraint to make sure that no individual worker gets more than 34 hours a week, just to prevent them from getting any kind of actual benefit. And you can turn that on or turn that off. And it was, you know, up to the user of the algorithm. And so that's, I think, one way for the builders of the algorithm, the statisticians, to somehow say that they're being morally neutral, that they, you know, you could turn it off and you could be nice to your workers. This is a great example of something that it's like when you can't lower your wages of your workers further than minimum wage, then you figure out another way to shortchange them. And the way you're shortchanging them with these scheduling algorithms is you're shortchanging their quality of life itself, which is to say they can't schedule a second job, they can't schedule babysitting, they can't go to night school. Night school used to be the way that people pulled themselves out of minimum wage work and into a real career, but it's impossible if you don't know your schedule in advance. So it's really degrading the existence of a bunch of, like, 30% of the people in the country. And it's something that, as you say, like, shareholders probably benefit from. So this is not, again, not something that the free market will necessarily address. We would have to address it with law.
And that's not very likely.
Or if not law, then at least some kind of leverage that the workers have over these companies. Yeah. So unions or something like that. I'm not saying it's likely. I'm just saying, like, this is where we are.
That's how you have to fix it. Yeah. It really is kind of the dystopian vision that some had in the 30s and 40s of the big machine, the computer, starting to run our lives. And, I think of Charlie Chaplin's Modern Times, where workers just become a cog in a machine. Yeah. And that was a reaction to the industrial era and assembly lines and so forth. And now it's pretty prettified, right? Because it's data, it's technology, it's computers. And it's so, while it's easy to see the inhumanity of a worker who's working on an assembly line doing the same thing over and over and over and over again, it's a lot harder to see how Starbucks scheduling software is inhumane. And yet it is absolutely the same. And so this dystopian vision has changed, but it's still with us. And it's very disappointing to me.
I wanted you should be my co-writer in my next book. It's so true. And, like, that's one of the reasons I felt like I had to write this book, right? Because I am a data scientist, and I'm good at explaining how technology and algorithms actually work so that people can get beyond their fear of mathematics and peer into what the actual consequences, human consequences, are of these hugely scaled algorithms.
Right. Right. And yet, as you point out, it's often not enough to – I mean, I always felt like our mission was to teach people about technology so they could use it on their behalf and fight it being used against them. But it seems very difficult for us to fight this. I guess the first step is to understand it's happening.
I think it's great for us to all, as many of us as possible, to understand what's happening. But I do want to caution that the people that are most hurt by this, that are most vulnerable to this kind of...
Yeah, they don't know.
They don't know, and they're not going to know anytime soon.
Yeah.
So we can't, like, let's put it this way. And this is an argument I get in with privacy folks a lot. Like, we cannot turn this into a be prepared by yourself, an individual responsibility type thing. This has to be something we address
societally.
A societal level, yes.
Yeah. Kathy O'Neill, our guest, Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. You know, it's hard to get people to read something that is bad news, but it's not just bad news. Let's talk more after we come back, maybe about some good news. And specifically, I want to talk a little bit about Facebook. You have a blog post that you put out today or yesterday. Facebook should hire me to audit their algorithm. We do live in an algorithmic world. It is possible, though, to make it better, I hope. Let's talk about it when we come back. We'll have more with Kathy in just a bit. We're running out of time. I want to get through this quickly, but I want to mention our sponsor, makes the show possible. You probably heard me talk about my Epson printer. I love it. The Epson EcoTank printers. Finally, a company comes along and does the right thing for customers. All the Epson EcoTank printers are cartridge-free printing. They all come with a tank and with up to 2 years of ink in the tank. So we bought one of them. There's a whole range from, you know, small to big. In fact, there's one for a work group that does like 20,000 pages between ink refills. But we got the 4550, which is kind of in the middle. I like it because it has that precision core engine. You've heard me talk about that. Epson brought that from their industrial printers. 40 million drops of ink a second. Super crisp black and white. Vivid colors. It does all the things an inkjet does best, which is instant startup, right? Auto two-sided full duplex printing, which is great because it not only saves papers, but you feel good about saving trees, right? It also, it's an all-in-one, so it scans and it faxes and it copies. But get this, when you buy the 4550, and we bought two now. We have one at home and one here. It comes with these bottles of ink, four bottles, and you know the CMYNK. And you fill up the tank with the bottles. Very easy. I've done it both times. It's a snap. And then now you've got like 2 years of ink in the printer. 11,000 black and white pages or 8,500 color pages. I mean, that could be more. It depends how much you print, but that could easily, for me, be 2 or 3 years. And the best part is when I go shopping for ink in 2018 or 2019, I'll be paying up to 80% less for the replacement bottles. That saves you a huge amount of money. I want you to check it out, the 30-page auto document feeder. It's Epson.com/EcoTank to learn more. This printer got the title of the CES 2016 Innovations Award. It also is the 2016 Small Biz Windows Printer of the Year. Rightly so. These EcoTank printers are amazing. Go to Epson, EPSON.com/EcoTank to transform the way your home, your office, your work group prints for the best combination of ease and value. Turn to the Epson EcoTank printers. And we thank Epson so much for their support. Epson, exceed your vision. A few minutes left with our guest, Kathy O'Neill. Kathy O'Neill is our guest, Weapons of Math Destruction. I don't want to leave on a sour note. Is there hope, Kathy? What, you know, of course, societally, we have to deal with this. What could Facebook do to make its algorithm better? How could we improve this?
Well, actually, Facebook's one of the hardest ones because Facebook is complicated, and the kind of destruction that it weaves is a little bit hard to extract. I'd say let's start off, if you don't mind, let's start off with the teacher value-added model. And it's also difficult, but the number one thing we do is to get rid of it because it's statistically bogus. But then if and when we decide to use data to improve teaching, I think we have to make sure it involves certain characteristics. And one of them, probably the most important one, is that there is a feedback loop. So we have some kind of way of measuring the extent to which an assessment is anywhere near to a qualitative assessment that is on the one hand expensive, but on the other hand, trusted. So we have to make sure there's a ground truth and that the idea is to get this assessment closer and closer to something that we trust. The second thing is we have to make sure it's accountable and that teachers can ask questions and push back. And I think the most important thing is to get the actual teachers involved with feedback about the algorithm. And that would mean something like not just getting a score, but getting sort of advice as to how to teach people better. So not just like, oh, you're a 48 out of 100, but like your students are lacking in this following kind of knowledge and you need to help them learn this knowledge in ways that teachers would actually find useful rather than just punitive. And that's just generally speaking, the way to look for algorithms that are not weapons of mass destruction is that, are they actually punishing people who are unlucky, poor, marginalized, or are they actually helping those people get better? And I think that's the sort of philosophical way of thinking about improving an algorithm. In terms of Facebook, I think you would need Facebook on board with this, and I don't see that happening anytime very soon. But the idea would be, what actually gets people to have civil conversations and to exchange ideas that change each other's minds, rather than simply fighting and sharing propaganda? That's a big question, and I don't know how to do it, but I think it's a really important one that we have to address quickly.
Ultimately, it sounds like what we need to do is trust humans more and machines less. That is difficult in a free market economy, but it is possible, starting by reading the book Weapons of Math Destruction, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy. And Kathy has a consultancy that's designed to audit your algorithms and make sure that they aren't inadvertently harming the people of our planet. We need to maybe trust these algorithms less and trust humans more. How about that?
Couldn't agree more.
Kathy, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time. I'm so glad you wrote the book. We'll get you back sometime and talk about data journalism, because I think that's very interesting, and I know you
sounds great. Are very Thanks for having me.
Thank you so Bye-bye. Much. The book, Weapons of Math Destruction, Kathy O'Neill, How Big Data Increases Inequality and Threatens Democracy, Amazon, Kindle, a bestseller on New York Times. A fascinating, fascinating story. We do triangulation every Monday, 11 a.m. Pacific, 2 p.m. Eastern time. That's 1900 UTC. If you could tune in and watch it live, we appreciate that, because your feedback is always valuable. This, I realize, unfortunately, we pre-recorded this, so I didn't get your feedback, and that really lets me know how much I need your feedback and like to hear your questions for our guests, your thoughts, and so forth. So next time, please come back on a Monday and join us. If you can't be here during the show, of course, we make on-demand audio and video available always after the fact, and you can find that at twit.tv/TRI or subscribe in your favorite app or podcatcher. There are many ways to watch now, and we're always working on more ways, because we want you to be able to see the shows. We make them free thanks to our advertising. We can do that. But we also make it free because I think it's really important that, you know, we learn about technology, its impact on our lives and on society, and how we as humans can use it better. Thanks for joining us. I'll see you next time on Triangulation. Bye-bye.